listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Mary R. Morgan, author of Beginning with the End, a memoir of twin loss and healing. In 1961, Michael Rockefeller, son of then-governor of New York State, Nelson A. Rockefeller, mysteriously disappeared off the remote coast of southern New Guinea. Amidst the glare of international public interest, the governor, along with his daughter Mary, Michael's twin, set off on a futile search only to return empty-handed and empty-hearted. What followed were Mary's 27 years of repression of her grief and an unconscious denial of her twin's death, which haunted her relationships and controlled her life. In her memoir, Beginning with the End, Mary R. Morgan struggles to claim an individual identity, which enables her to face Michael's death and the huge loss it engendered. With remarkable honesty, she shares her spiritually evocative healing journey and her story of moving forward into a life of new beginnings and meaning, especially in her work with others who have lost a twin. Mary R. Morgan is a licensed psychotherapist specializing in working with twinless twins. She lectures on the subject of twin loss and has led a bereavement group for twins whose twin died in the 9/11 World Trade Center disaster. She's presently on sabbatical writing a new book for grief counselors, which explores the unique treatment issues facing grieving twins. We talk about that a little bit in our interview. Ms. Morgan is a licensed imagery guide and trainer. She is also the executive producer of two forthcoming documentaries on the myth of the gene and the risks of genetic engineering. She's married and has three children and seven grandchildren. When I spoke to Mary R. Morgan in December, I began by asking her to read an excerpt from the beginning of her memoir, and then we talked about it after that.
The sea change began in November 1961. I remember the moment before. A window in the corner of my parents' living room drew my attention. A wind-blown branch from an azalea bush scratched its surface, making a discordant sound, an intermittent squeaking. The branch had strayed way past its sculpted boundary. Why hadn't my mother had it pruned? My father stands out clearly, his figure powerful and solid next to the soft down-pillowed sofa, his face squared off by his right-angled jaw. By the window, my two brothers and I are clustered around my mom, wary and watching him. His arrival and bold presence had pushed our little group away and drawn us together. Why had he come? Why had he called us to meet? As it was Sunday, we had gathered at our country home in Pocantico Hills, New York. It was barely 2 months since Father had separated from our mother, and just days before he'd called a press conference, choosing to publicly expose his affair and his decision to remarry. My brothers and I were still reeling from the family fracture, trying to make sense of our own feelings, trying to support our mother. Father held a yellow cablegram in his hand. He extended it towards us as if to give reality to his words. I have troubling news. This morning the State Department wired me. I just finished talking to them at Uncle David's. They received word from the Dutch government in New Guinea. They don't know the specifics yet, but Mike is missing. Missing. The S sound. Like a thin knife, it slipped deep inside me. No resistance, just a sharp, knowing pain, and then shimmering silence. I could feel the shimmering spread, numbing any feeling or sensation. I watched myself retreat from the others. There must have been questions, anguished, fearful questions. What were my family's reactions? They must have shared some form of horror and then disbelief. I remember the force of Father. He always solved the problems at hand, and he had already come up with a plan. He would go to New Guinea, he said, leaving that night. The family office was arranging for the planes. There he would help to coordinate the search efforts and mobilize the necessary support. And he would charter a small seaplane so he could visit the coastal villages where people knew or had heard of Michael. He wanted to see for himself, to talk to the local villagers. They would know best where Michael might be. Responding to Father's confidence, I found my way back to the group. Within his warmth and within the solid structure of his resolve, I emerged from the silence. "I want to go with you, Father," I said. Yes, I would go with Father to look for Michael. As I joined Father's mission in my mind, lost, engulfed in silence, began to turn into found. And I began to develop my own vision. Father and I would travel together to this foreign land. We would search and we would find Michael. I could even see him when we found him. Disheveled, valiant, and even a bit surprised at our concern. Not easily prone to worry or fear, he would have surmounted the obstacles and landed on his feet as he always had. In a fleeting fantasy, I became the princess departing with my father, the king, to find the lost prince, soon to be reunited in twinship as it was meant to be. Early the next morning, we started the long journey across the Pacific Ocean to the Dutch East Indies. Due to the nature of the crisis and the difficulty of finding a scheduled flight, Father had chartered a plane to take us with refueling stops to the west coast of New Guinea. We had been accompanied by a few familiar reporters from New York City newspapers on the first leg of the trip, but the news of Michael's disappearance had quickly spread, and in the Honolulu airport we found ourselves surrounded by a growing crowd of journalists. My eyes widened and blinked into a sea of noisy, aggressive faces and flashing lights. Father's somber words fed their questions, enabling their ranks to open and part, offering us a path to the stairs to the plane. I felt his protective arm as we climbed up and away from the reporters into the safe belly of the plane. I never expected that inside we would face a similar scene. We found ourselves within a new group of strange, staring faces, except this time there were no cameras, and the sounds of conversation we heard upon entering turned to expectant silence that spread up and down the aisle as we found our seats in the front of the large cabin. Father turned and spoke again, welcoming these new seated reporters, telling them about the journey ahead, introducing them, revealing our private, now public search for Michael. Our Michael. And I thought fiercely, my Michael, not theirs. I felt that these reporters, with their questioning and analyzing, these reporters who seemed to siphon Father's quiet words from his mouth into their notebooks, were stepping on and into our very private lives, into our mission, as if they were claiming it before it could carry itself out on its own. I didn't dare ask Father why he had to charter such a large plane, or why he felt it necessary to play host to this swelling group of press. His arrangements confused, dispirited, and even angered me. As a family, we had gotten used to the publicity that surrounded us since he became governor of New York. I had mixed feelings about the public attention. In the circle of Father's aura, I became an exciting somebody. But I found this attention fickle and sometimes invasive, and I was beginning to become aware that any public image I had acquired had little to do with the person I was inside. The fact that I belonged to the Rockefeller family only made the discrepancy worse, for I quickly became the image of people's preconceptions. Now I realized it would be the press corps that would try to define our unfolding reality and create the dominant images. I think I must have displaced the anger I felt then at Father onto the press. I found myself in way over my head, in a situation without context, holding on for dear life to Father's strength and ability to control our family's destiny and to grasp a victory out from under any shadow of defeat. Sitting beside him, I reached for his hand, for I could feel my own sense of self shrinking and our fairy tale mission beginning to fade and break apart. Where was Michael in this press corps, vision? It was too unsafe to reach for the answer.
Thank you so much for reading that. That was a very powerful opening to the book. What do you believe happened to Mike?
Well, I think the evidence points pretty clearly to the fact that he drowned.
Mm-hmm.
His boat, he was collecting art for the Museum of Primitive Art off the southern coast of New Guinea from a tribe of people called the Asmat people.
Mm-hmm.
They were brilliant sculptors. And Michael was there on a small catamaran made out of two canoes with a platform that held them together and a big outboard motor and a small roof that they had built out of corrugated tin. And that, when they wanted to take a shortcut and go across a huge delta of something called the Ilandan River, and in order to reach a small riverlet that held a village with very good sculptors in it,
mm-hmm.
and Michael's boat overturned in a very choppy sea with an outgoing, huge outgoing tide, a full moon, and a great big pulling draft of water that went down the coast all the way south and out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
So when this boat capsized and the two guides, these young guides, jumped off to try to swim to safety, which they did, he was left on the boat with his anthropologist friend, and they floated out to sea for about a day trying to paddle this thing. It actually capsized, the whole boat capsized, so that they were sitting on the upside down canoes with their feet on the platform in the water. And they realized that there was no hope. I mean, all their luggage washed away, except for one or two small things, Michael's journals that he kept, and they had no food or water. It was a jungle, huge jungle area with, in those days in 1961, no traveling of any kind except one seaplane once a week that went and dropped mail to a couple of missionaries that lived in some of the small villages.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael felt the best thing for him to do was to try to swim. And Rene, his friend and anthropologist, didn't really swim well at all. So he tried to swim ashore, and he was never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
I figure he was probably about 10 miles, 12 miles out to sea.
Mm-hmm. And there was some controversy over the fact that the area is known for headhunters. So that would have added to the chaos of trying to figure out what had happened.
Yes, it did. And this was a territory belonging to the Dutch government, who was in conflict with Indonesia at the time, who wanted that territory. And the local people had been discouraged from headhunting for probably about 10, 20 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And there was remote evidences that they had continued this as a way in which to, when they had conflicts between tribes, the deaths of maybe one or the other of them had to be revenged through a headhunting.
Mm.
And so there were terrible stories about Michael in this context. And they have gone on for 50 years.
Yeah, which must have just made everything so much worse.
There's been no evidence that's been produced in any way
mm-hmm.
that he lived and made it to shore and then was killed.
Yeah. Did you in the end feel like joining your father on the trip was a mistake?
Oh, no.
No.
No, I thought it was really a key in terms of my understanding about Michael and why he loved these people so much
mm-hmm.
and why he was so touched by the complete nature of their lives in terms of being connected to all the rhythms of nature and the important issues of life and death and beauty and making beauty part of your life. All of that they connected to without any reserve and in a very complete and holistic way.
Mm-hmm.
He loved these people, and I could see it when we went to visit the villages.
One story that you tell in the book that really struck me was in the midst of all that you were going through, and, you know, your whole family was going through a lot, and so everybody was sort of dealing with it on his or her own, and then the press was really not very empathic or sympathetic toward you on this trip, but there was a moment on the trip where a woman from one of the villages came up to you, and she couldn't speak your language, but she just took your hand and made a connection with you by looking at you, and it was very clear that she understood what you were going through, and that was such a beautiful moment in the book. So.
It was something that stays with me all my life.
Yeah.
And it was something interesting, Shayla, about that, because here was this old woman
mm-hmm.
who didn't know me, but who connected with me by holding my hands, looking into my eyes, and then I could see the tears in her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that she understood.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing in our culture is that we're not connected to each other in grief.
Mm-hmm.
We can't fix each other's grief, but we can stay in relationship. And that's what this woman did. She was the only one on the whole trip who was really in relationship to me. And it was just very touching, and I've never forgotten it.
Yeah, it was a very intense moment in the book. Mary, when did you begin to write Beginning with the End?
Probably 6 years ago.
Okay, so it's not something that you were working on for 30 years and not quite sure what you'd do with, or...
Not at all.
Okay.
No, the twins. I worked with the twins in the 9/11 Twin Tower disaster. I worked with a group of twins who had lost their twin brother or sister in that disaster. And that was an extremely moving experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones who suggested I write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it really for three reasons. One is because when I saw how incredibly connected they were in such a beautiful, trusting way, you know, from the moment they met each other. Twins understand and can connect that mm-hmm. way. And that was so moving to me. And then the way they shared their story, and I realizing that I had never really shared my story. Even though I had done a wonderfully powerful healing experience, it was not with twins. And I had never shared the twin part of my story.
Right.
And so I had this deep connection and sense of wanting to sit down with them and just be part of the group, and then realizing that I had the gift of being there to help them and to understand them,
mm-hmm.
and that wasn't possible. Then they wanted me, they told me, I worked with them for 2 years, and they told me at the end of the first year they wanted me to write a book so that people would understand the unique issues of twin loss.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't help thinking of this little boy, you know, in this terrible school disaster in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little boy, a little girl now who's left. Her brother, Noah, her twin brother just was shot, you
mm-hmm.
know, with part of those 20 children that were
yes.
shot.
Mm-hmm.
And here this little girl is there by herself.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't help but feel so touched by the sadness of that.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that strikes me is that, you know, for better or for worse, twins are very often treated as a unit. You know, a pair of twins is a unit. And so when the outside world looks at you and says that you're half of this unit, and then suddenly you find yourself alone, there is a sort of a lack of experience with that kind of independence that I think must make it so much harder than being just a sibling to somebody else. I mean, we all love our siblings, but it's a little bit different, you know, and it's been set up to put you in that position. I would think.
Very different. And I think you've put your finger right on the paired issue of the paired issues or unique issues that are paired, which define the twin loss experience.
Mm-hmm.
And one is the twin bond, because twins grow in relationships since the moment of their conception. And it's so fascinating because in the sonogram studies that they're doing now, they have been able to document that twins are reaching out to each other in intentional connection at 14 weeks of age. The little fetuses at 14 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, this is incredible. So by the time they are born, they not only have a sense of them, a beginning sense of I, but they are that sense of their identity is framed in a we.
Yeah.
And so this is what you're talking about. And so even when they first come into the world, they see themselves as a we, not as only an I.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending a lot on how they're brought up, how their parents see them, and as you said, are they seen as a unit, or are they encouraged to find out who they are as individuals? This has to be delicately handled in the nurturing of twins in a family.
Mm-hmm. It seems so unfair to me that twins are put in this position by society in some ways, and then afterwards, there's this sense of it's time to move on. You should be getting better now. You should be over this. And these are the same individuals that said you're one of two. You know, it's just it really struck me how difficult that would be.
Well, I think you're right. And the twins in the Trade Tower disaster, they said to me often they weren't acknowledged at all after the disaster. If the twin was married, the wife or husband was acknowledged and supported. And the parents of the twins were very much supported. But the twinship itself was not acknowledged in terms of the deep grieving and the enormous length of time that it takes.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult for these twins in that way.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about a moment in the book, a sort of another connection moment. You were sort of newly married, as I understand it, when Michael disappeared. Your husband was Bill. He was in the service. And he was on leave at one point, and the two of you were on a vacation, and you took a canoe trip through some rapids, and the canoe almost capsized. Can you talk about that and about what happened to you emotionally in that moment?
Well, you know, we were in the Philippines, and we had this week together, and somebody in the hotel told us about this incredible trip you could take with these on this white water canoe trip, they called it, where you were in this canoe, and you went down this river that started as a waterfall and then went through these incredible rapids, and that it was just an enormously amazing trip and very exciting. And you know, we asked about it, and the man at the hotel said they were a very educated people who did this, and they had spent many years training. And so my husband loved that kind of adventuresome thing, and frankly, I was so numb. Usually I would have said, no, 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 it was so scary, I wouldn't possibly do such a thing. I was always the one who was scared, and Michael was always the one who went forward into an experience, and I held back and then would reluctantly come forward. So I agreed to do it basically because I didn't have much feeling about anything. And so we went up there, and it was a beautiful, beautiful river. It started with an extraordinarily majestic falls, you know, and then it evened out into a smooth river. And then, so we were in the middle of this canoe with two men on either end, and then all of a sudden, we were in this incredibly rapid descent. And the thing happened so fast, and for some reason, and I can't understand this, but for some reason, the movement of the canoe was so rapid and so extraordinarily connected to the river itself. And we we seem to become one with the water.
Hmm.
And obviously the men knew that what they were doing. But the canoe seemed to me to be the thing that was finding its way in among these boulders and all the way down with such speed and with such a rush. I mean, in that one moment, I had a sense of so much of what Michael had experienced in his life. He loved to ski fast,
mm-hmm.
and he loved to just join experiences with a rush of fun and a rush of joy. And
yeah.
in that moment, I understood it.
Mm-hmm. I was actually, in reading that, I was surprised you'd get in that canoe. And I know you were numb and you weren't quite yourself, but particularly given the way that he disappeared, I wondered if this would end up being a much more traumatic experience. And then when I read the story, I thought, oh, good, that was a wonderful experience. You know, it was a nice connection. But looking back, are you surprised you got in that canoe?
I am. I don't know whether I would do it today.
Yeah.
I think I was so out of it that my usual sense of protective mechanisms were not in play, did not come into play. And then in a strange way, you know, I had the same sense when we landed in the plane on the way home. I also wrote about that when I landed in Tehran.
Right.
In this incredible desert with this beautiful sunrise that came and spread pink and white all over the desert, and we landed like this arrow. I was allowed to go up in the front of the plane.
Oh, right. The pilots invited you.
Yeah, yes. It was the same sort of dissociative thing, but again, it connected me with Michael. Mm-hmm. In a way that was very beautiful and very momentary, but it stayed with me all my life.
Yeah. Yeah. So now that those kinds of moments are so important and they make you feel connected, I'm wondering if there were other kinds of moments where you looked for meaning where perhaps there was none. Do you know what I'm talking about? That you were so... I'm drawing on personal experience where you lose a person and you are so desperate for connection or for meaning that you look everywhere for it.
I think what comes to mind was that, Michael was lost and never found. His
right.
body was never found. And,
right.
People made their peace with that and moved on with their life, and I didn't. And I, you know, had two levels within me of knowing. One was this conceptual level where I realized with everybody else, and my therapist told me that I had to move on with my life and
right.
get on with my life.
Right.
And, but I, in this sense of what you're talking about, I felt I saw Michael. I felt I saw him in the street and that he was going to come home, and somehow maybe he'd found his way home, and if I could just catch up to him, then he would be there, and it would be somehow. And I mean, you know, that's a kind of knowing that comes from a place inside ourselves that is not connected to rational thinking,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
but is very real. And those are the kinds of experiences people have in the grieving process. And they are normal experiences.
Yeah.
You see, this is the thing where people need to understand how, and this is what I try to explain in the book, you know, how we go through these different levels of knowing and reaching and hoping, you know. I mean, that kind of hoping against hope, because I had no closure of seeing a dead body or knowing that he was dead.
Yes.
The twins
right.
in the Trade Center disaster, in the Twin Towers, you know, numbers of them had no closure either.
Yeah.
Because they never have found, their bodies were never found.
Right.
So that, I think, lends itself to this sense of trying to find meaning and trying to find a literal kind of meaning. So I began to develop a sense of myself over the years, and it took me 27 years to heal from this,
mm-hmm.
from this tragedy, so that I am in a good place to share with people who have had long, extended grieving experiences and who get stuck in those experiences. But one of the things of searching for meaning was in the Museum of Metropolitan Art, where Michael's, the great collection that he made that now resides in the museum, that was a searching for meaning, and it turned out to be very meaningful for me.
Yeah. You mentioned that it took 27 years. And not to assign blame, I don't think that your book at all tries to assign blame, but I do think that part of why it took you so long was that there were people telling you to, you know, rein in your emotions. Your mother admonished that, you know, what we should not do is cry. And as you said, your psychiatrist said it's time to
move on.
To move on.
And she didn't understand the twinship at all.
Mm.
And I had to really find my deep connection as a twin and the meaning of that all by myself.
Right.
But
right.
I was really admonished to move on.
Yes. Right. And I was really interested to see your distinction in the book of moving on versus moving forward. I thought
mm-hmm.
that was a wonderful way of putting, you know, what people might want to focus on,
yes.
you know,
exactly.
when they're feeling ready to move forward, but not leave the person and the loss completely behind as though it never happened.
See, that's so important, because I think that what we're really letting go of in the grieving process is the physical manifestation of the person that no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that person leaves. In reality, we'll never see them again. But that physical self is imprinted in our hearts and in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally have to acknowledge at a certain point deep inside ourselves that person is gone. And once we've done that, once we really fully in all parts of ourselves can acknowledge that loss and grieve that loss and then bear witness to the life that was so meaningful to us, then we can begin to make a new relationship to our loved one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the relationship that leaves. It's the physical person that's gone. No one can take my twinship from me.
Mm-hmm.
I am always a twin. Just like a person who loses their husband, they aren't all of a sudden not a wife anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But people think that just because their twin died, they're no longer a twin. That's not right.
Right. Or if a spouse, if you lose a spouse and you remarry, all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, she's gotten over it or he's gotten over it. I would think that that's, you know,
And if you take the time to grieve and fully, you know, complete the bearing witness to that relationship that you had with your wife or husband, then you are then open to loving again.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship you had can literally inform and nourish the new relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it isn't doing something shameful to the old relationship. Do you see what I mean? People
Absolutely.
Have a lot of trouble feeling guilty about making new relationships. And we have to work through those places of guilt that we naturally feel. So that's also part of the healing experience, is bearing witness to all these different kinds of feelings, the anger, the guilt, the shame. Years later, as I talk about in the section called Moving Forward, years later, I read a piece that was in my father's files in the family archives that was written by Rene Wassing, who was the man who was with
mm-hmm.
Michael on the boat. And he gave this press conference to the press in New Guinea, and I didn't go to that. I'm almost sure I didn't. And I'm sure I didn't. And that was then transcribed. And it was a very clear rendition of what happened to him, to Rene and Michael, and tells exactly what happened with Michael and the discussions they had and everything before
Right.
Michael left. I had never read that until 27 years. I know, I had never read that till 40-some years after when I started to write this book.
What a shame. And so even after you started doing your work with the twins, for example, of the Trade Center, you had not at that point heard that whole transcript or read
it? I had not. It was only when I started to do the research to write the book so that I got all the things right in terms of the dates and everything. Then I read this, and at that time, a new piece that needed to be healed came up.
Mm.
And that was the unbelievable guilt and shame I felt about not being able to be there with him when he died,
mm-hmm.
and not knowing how he died so that I could bear witness and share that with him.
Well, and if you look at survivor's guilt and then you consider what I was saying before about twins being treated as a unit, it's almost like, you know, how intense that guilt must feel given that relationship.
It's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I felt a huge amount of that, and that he was a better person than me, and why did I stay here? And you know, now I have the sense that Michael's life, you know, everybody has their own sense of how things work, but over all the years, it's come to me that Michael's short life was very complete in its own way, and that he was here with me and with my family in a way that was quite special in relationship to the family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he never got embroiled in all the sort of goings-on of the family and, you know, the emotional ups and downs. And he really felt to me that his whole life was focused on connecting in a larger way.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow his life was complete in its shortness, and that I needed to stay here a long time to grow.
Do you think his ability to have achieved that so young had to do with being a Rockefeller and had to do with perhaps wanting to make his own mark on the world?
Well, I do think that Michael and I and all of my siblings and my whole family were brought up to believe that we were, to understand that we were given an enormous amount, that we were very privileged and we needed to give back, that we needed to make the world a better place for our having been in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael and I spent hours discussing, you know, how we could find out who we were outside of the Rockefeller family,
mm-hmm.
and what our lives were meant to mean. So in that sense, I think we wanted to be who we were ourselves. And in the other sense, we wanted, and then I think that's part of why Michael went to New Guinea, was to find out about himself outside of the Rockefeller family, outside of anybody knowing who he was.
I have a related question to that, and that is, do you think that losing your brother, losing your twin, would have been a great deal different had you not been a Rockefeller? And I know that sounds like a little bit of a silly question, but, you know, it just struck me that the press was involved, that there was so much in the news, and you had to be present for everybody who was watching.
I think it was very difficult. I think it was really very difficult, and I think it threw me deeply into isolation, which is something that people who have had deep personal loss, whether they're a twin or not, know all about, that sense of isolation. And I think I had it in spades. I think it was added to by the limelight and the press and all of that I felt disconnected. I hesitate always to compare myself to other people because it's so difficult to know what's happening inside another person and what are the issues that they are facing. And people grieve in different ways. That's another thing.
Yes, right. I wanted to ask you a couple questions about being a reader and a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those questions is, what do you like to read, or what are you reading now or have read recently?
Well, I love to read books about people who are experiencing a challenge in their lives and who meet that challenge, or about families and or cultures that are experiencing, you know, challenges of meaning, and who meet those challenges through interconnection. I am reading, I just finished a book called Salvage the Bones.
Okay.
And it's by Jessam Ward.
Okay.
Jess, she actually won the National Book Award for this book in 2010. And it was written after Katrina.
Oh, okay.
And this is a young Black American, African American woman who wrote this book about a Black family in the South. I think it's in Louisiana. And who struggle with the issues of just surviving in their family. And this woman who writes it in the first person, as a young woman in this barely subsisting family, and is fascinated with her school and the myths that she's reading about, the Greek myths, and then the family is hit by Katrina, that huge hurricane. So that's what that book is about, and her holding on to trying to find a sense of self within this whole disaster. And then the other book I just finished was the book called Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver.
How was that?
Oh, it's fabulous. Her latest book. I think she's a beautiful writer.
Yes.
And she writes about this town in Tennessee where this entire huge migration of monarch butterflies comes and settles in the woods above this town because their whole area in Mexico has been decimated by a storm and by mudslides that have ruined their habitat. And what happens to this small farming town? And again, another woman who's trying to find out her sense of self. Sort of coincidental that they're both around that issue.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love Barbara Kingsolver. I have not read the Jessamine Ward, but I look forward to it.
And also, you know, I mean, I love to read about the environment, and I'm very interested in genetic engineering and the whole issue of genetic determinism and what's that. And what that means in terms of the values that we hold dear in this country. I'm very worried about genetic determinism, especially as our world begins to polarize with the difficulties that we're challenged with. I'm working on a film about that now.
Okay.
So that's another part of my life.
Yeah, interesting. And I was just going to ask you what you're working on now. So are you, I'd love to hear about the film, but I'm also curious if you're writing another book.
Yeah, I'm struggling between the idea of writing a book for therapists on dealing with twin loss and the specific issues of twin loss, or writing a small book about what I've learned about grieving, and which would be a more universal kind of book with stories. So I'm very challenged because I'm not right now in practice, and I took a sabbatical from my practice, and I miss it terribly. And so I'm kind of struggling to figure out what my next path is and whether I should go back into private practice again. I do a lot of group work now, and I work with the Twinless Twins Support Group International. I'm interested in the research, in encouraging research in twin loss. I'm working with Catherine Scheer in discussions about the whole issue of complicated grief, as she's doing fabulous research. She comes from Columbia. She's a psychiatrist at Columbia University. So there's that piece, the research piece, that's so important also.
Yeah. Now, are you in the city? Are you in Manhattan?
I'm in Manhattan.
Okay. Right. So if you were to open up your practice again, that would be...
It would be right there. And I do some consulting work also now.
Okay.
Every now and then I do a very short consulting piece and that kind of thing.
I wanted to ask you, who in particular would you like to see reading this book? And how would you hope that this book might affect those readers?
The people I hope to connect with are people who have had deep personal loss. And I hope, obviously, to connect with twins so that I can, so that they can better understand what's happening to them and know that they're not alone.
Yeah.
But I would like to connect on a larger, more universal level with people who are grieving from deep personal loss. I want to break the isolation that pervades that loss and touch the places where people become disconnected from themselves.
Yeah.
And if people, anybody who, you know, I'd love to share this with anybody who's interested and hopefully to open them up to a larger sense of understanding of themselves and the whole, you know, loss and death issue that affects all of us.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Mary, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. I'm going to mention the book is Beginning with the End, A Memoir of Twin Loss and Healing, published by Vantage Point Press. Thank you for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, I enjoyed speaking with you too, Shayla. Thank you for your program.
That, again, was a conversation with Mary R. Morgan. You can learn more about her work on her website, beginningwiththeend.com. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Penicluse Cafe, a team that creates a multitude of baked goodies, soups, daily specials, and creative cocktails. Penicluse offers a range of cuisine and is available to cater special events. Penicluse is located in downtown Burlington at the corner of Cherry and South Winooski and at penicluse.com. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. Bear Pond Books and The Chef's Table present Vermont author Jennifer McMahon at a book release party for her new book, The One I Left Behind. To be held at Chef's Table, 118 Main Street in Montpelier, January 8th from 7 to 9. More information at 802-229-0774. The Fletcher Free Library in Burlington presents readings by Fomite Press authors in the Fletcher Room, Wednesday, January 9th at 7. Fomite Press is Burlington's independent publishing house. Phoenix Books in Burlington presents the Reverend Gary Kowalski, author of Blessings of the Animals and Minister Emeritus of Burlington's First Unitarian Universalist Society, Thursday, January 10th at 7. The Reverend Kowalski, who's a former guest on my show, he will share true stories about animals and meditation, technology, art, and culture. Eve LaPlante will be at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center on Friday, January 11th at 7, presenting her groundbreaking work, Marmee and Louisa, The Untold Story of Louisa May Alcott and Her Mother. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library presents its next pair of Shape and Share Life Stories workshops, Monday, January 14th and Monday, January 28th from 12:30 to 2:30. Prompts trigger real-life experience stories which are crafted into narratives and shared with the group. The workshop is led by Racille Hamrell. Phoenix Books Burlington will offer a viewing of a live webcast from Carnegie Hall Tuesday, January 15th at 7. John and Hank Green, with special guests the Mountain Goats, will celebrate the anniversary of The Fault in Our Stars. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Mary R. Morgan. It might best help writers who are working with difficult personal material. Mary was able to begin her book and handle all the emotions she had to work through to write about the loss of her twin, Michael, by holding a little spiritual ceremony at the beginning and at the end of each writing session. She made a small altar, and she held the work in a kind of sacred place, which she could then make an ending to whenever she finished writing. This helped her to keep all of those emotions and difficult memories from overtaking her life. She says, "It was very beautiful. I found when I had to go back to that journey, I had to really reconnect with those feelings, and that was difficult. And so doing that in a spiritual context was very helpful. I asked for inspiration and protection, and I voiced my gratitude for the ability to do this." Mary says that a lot of the inspiration for her ceremony came from the work she had already done in the natural world. She received a lot of spiritual comfort from this approach to her writing time. This week, and perhaps moving forward, if you find it helpful, create a ritual that embraces your writing time. You don't need an altar, and you don't need to follow Mary's or anyone else's specific path, but try to find your own way to celebrate your work this week, marking it with a protective and inspirational ceremony of some sort. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. There's no www in front of that. It's just writethebook.podbean.com. I am now accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. If you are happy with something that you've written after using a prompt that you heard on Write the Book, feel free to email it to me. I have submission guidelines up on the website. There's a tab at the top of the page for reading the submission guidelines. So there's no guarantee that it will make it onto the show, and I won't even be reading them every week. But from time to time, I might read some of the better outcomes that are sent to me. Also, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a guest to recommend that I interview, or a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.